Sports Ethos New York Knicks podcast. Andre Gallagher, fresh off this victory in Portland. I'm not breaking down this game. Portland is playing their young boys. They don't have their, you know, most of their building blocks playing. It's a game the Knicks had to win and they won. I'm not going to sit here and, oh, they should have beat them by more and blah, blah. That's not how the NBA works. Those guys out there playing hard. They're the guys who are playing are defensive guys, not offensive guys. So those kinds of guys, they work hard, they hustle, they make things difficult, and they did that for the Knicks. And, you know, some of the issues that the Knicks have with no Randle and a half OG and a three quarters of Hartenstein continue to come to a head, but it's something that you expect. And you probably should not. Number one, you shouldn't be surprised. Number two, you shouldn't continue to complain about it because this team's ceiling is limited without Julius Randle. That's not like it's not new. It's not new. But what I did tell you is with OG on the floor, they are competitive against any team in the league in a regular season. Not to say this Portland team or this Portland game solidifies that point. It's just to make the case that, yes, they can fight, scrap, and claw against any team in the league, especially if OG and Hartenstein are playing. They are defensive anchors and defensive playmakers in different ways, of course. To that point, OG, as we all know, if you're listening to this podcast, you either saw the game or you're reading the stories. The way OG was favoring that elbow has got to scare you half to death. Because OG is not the difference maker on the court when he can't use his other arm. And it got to a point last night where he could not use his right arm. That has got to be cause for concern, man. It really has got to be cause for concern. Now, he's going to play the next game. The next game is on Sunday. He's going to play. Just like he played this game, where he was a left-handed bandit, I watched OG have a ball handler drive by him on his right side, and he reached all the way over his across his body with his left hand to swipe at the ball because he didn't want to use his right hand. Every time he used his right arm, he grabbed at his elbow. And the one thing that you were concerned about, or you should have been, and if you have half a brain, you should have been concerned about it, was his shooting, right? That was the case as soon as you heard he hurt his right elbow. That had to be the first thing you thought of was, okay, what's going to happen to his shot? And then the first game back, he hit some shots, and you're like, oh, he's fine. All right, good. And then you watch this game, and it's like, wait, he's not good. He's not good at all. Not at all. He looks like that's how you shoot when your elbow doesn't work. Exactly how he shot. Now, I noticed that in the first game, even though he made the shot, it looked like it was a little awkward. You know, I was late to the game or I missed his first three. The first make, I missed it. And I saw a couple of misses and I'm like, ugh, that doesn't look like his normal shot. He's not the smoothest shooter to begin with, but that didn't look like his normal shot. And if you watch him shoot last night, that doesn't look like his normal shot at all. And it was way off and forced. It looked like the way you shoot when you can't shoot threes. You know, when you go to a court, you ever been to the NBA Hall of Fame, the Naismith Hall of Fame, I should say, and they had that big court and everyone's shooting around, they're shooting threes, and people realize how far that three-point shot is. And you see people, they might be able to stand 10 feet in front of the rim and hit a jump shot, and they try to shoot a three, and it's like they're trying to throw the ball 100 yards. That's the way it looked when he was shooting. And I'm troubled. Color me troubled. Because OG, like that, yeah, his defense is still there, man, but he's grabbing his elbow. He couldn't even dribble with his right hand. I noticed in the second half, he wouldn't even dribble with his right hand. And he's not even the strongest left-hand dribbler. And he was avoiding his right hand, and he was avoiding straightening his arm. But I said this to Rid Holzman on Twitter. Why does his name always perplex me? Very popular Twitter profile. I see it all the time. It's a pun on Red Holzman, and I keep mixing his name and Red Holzman's name, whatever. I'm a doofus. But I said in a tweet that he posted, and he was also concerned, there's a difference. It's obvious that he's hurt. That's obvious. Like, there was some debate. I shouldn't say there was debate, but, you know, once you saw him come back in the game and you heard the post-game comments, you're like, okay, he's not hurt. He's just sore or whatever. No. He's hurt. He's not hurt. He's hurt. The question is he injured? Is he too injured to last the regular season and the playoffs? Is this an expected pain, an expected soreness, an expected discomfort, or is this an aggravation of the injury? All reports suggest that it's just discomfort. But the Knicks have not necessarily been honest about these things, and I don't expect them to be honest. I think there's a lot of talk about how the Knicks organization owes fans certain pieces of information. I don't believe that. They only say that when the Knicks are losing. When the Knicks are losing and things aren't right, then everybody's owed an explanation. When the Knicks are playing well and they're one of the best teams in January and they're blowing everyone out and they have a plus 20 net rating when OG is on the floor, nobody needs an explanation anymore. You know, it's only when things aren't going well that they want explanation. Be consistent. Either you want it when they're winning and you want it when they're winning and losing. Don't just ask for it when they're losing and be perfectly okay when they're winning. All right? The Knicks do not give out this kind of information freely. They tell you when they know for sure. And they tell you after they know for sure and feel like telling you. And I don't care. Just because I want to know doesn't mean it's my right to know. As long as the players know, that's all that really matters. At the end of the day, with these injuries, man, it's really about your ability to manage your emotions. Because it literally is what it is. Hurt, injured, whatever. Aggravation, discomfort, whatever it is, it's all about your worry and concern. Because it's going to be what it's going to be. It's not like it's a coaching decision. It's not like it's a rotation decision. It's about his health. And if it's not good enough, if he's going to be out, if he's going to be in and half playing, whatever it is what it is. And it doesn't make sense to worry about it and beat yourself into a stupor about it. Like, I'm worried, I'm concerned, but you got to manage your emotions, manage your feelings. All right. There are some conversations about sitting him until he's perfectly healthy. I don't know if the Knicks have the luxury of doing that, but one thing that we do know is that OG, or I should say Tibbs, is not going to half-ass anybody who's on the court. If you're playing, you're playing. And unless they put him on an official minutes restriction, which they have not. And remember, Hartenstein was on a... I'm not going to say it was kind of like a minute restriction. They were trying to ramp him up so he can play his normal amount of minutes. And Tibbs was trying to abide by that. And remember, if you remember, Hartenstein was a little pissed off because Tibbs didn't get up to his minutes that he was supposed to have. He was supposed to have 20 minutes that first game back, and he didn't get to that number, and he was angry about that or frustrated about that, whatever that was the word he used. Because Tibbs, at the end of the day, is going to play who he needs to play to win the game. He benched Precious early in the fourth quarter. Precious, one thing about Precious is it does seem like he has another gear, and sometimes it takes him a minute to get there. He might come into the game with that gear every now and then, but that's not his default. His default setting is not that gear that he's been playing with. That's his locked in, motivated, ready to rock and roll gear. That's not the gear he takes his warm-ups off at. And he came into that game in the fourth quarter in half gear, and Tibbs promptly pulled him out of the game, right? But Tibbs is going to play the people he needs to play to win the game in his mind. And unless you put OG on a minute restriction, OG is going to play the amount of minutes that Tibbs thinks he needs to play so that he's ready for the playoffs. Because Tibbs believes, he doesn't believe in rest for the playoffs. He believes that your body gets used to playing a certain amount of minutes so that you're at your best when the playoffs come. That's what he believes. That it's not a shock to the system when you're asked to play big minutes at a high level because you're used to doing that. And on the flip side, when you've been playing 20, 25 minutes for weeks and then you go into the playoffs and you got to play 35, 45 minutes, that's how you get hurt and that's how you're not as effective. That's how you end up being not as effective. That is his belief system. And I don't think it's wrong. That was what Pat Riley believed. That's what heat culture is supposed to be. Now, does Jimmy Butler do what he want to do? Yes. Okay. But that's why the Miami Heat end up in the situations they end up in, where they have to be in the play-in and they're almost out the playoffs the same year they make it to the finals. Right? But that's what heat culture is, and that's what Knick culture is. So if you're going to criticize Tibbs, criticize Pat Riley. So unless they put OG on a minutes restriction, he's playing. I don't know if somebody needs to put him on a minute restriction. That's all I'm saying. I can't be mad at Tibbs until somebody puts him on a minute restriction. I don't know if a minute restriction is actually going to solve the problem. It seems like, I don't know, you use your elbow a lot when you play basketball. It doesn't matter if it's at 40 minutes or 25 minutes, your elbow is going to get used. It's going to get used. And if it hurts every time he uses it, which is what it looked like in that Portland game, man, one thing I don't want to see is I don't want to see him come back in the game unnecessarily. But there's two things at play here. And you heard Josh Hart ask about this, and there was some more conversation about why. Because the legitimate minutes police conversation with Tibbs is why he keeps putting people back in the game when the game is out of reach, and the game is a blowout. That is a legitimate criticism and one that I've been on, just like everybody else. I don't get bothered by the minutes. I get bothered by people being in games that are blowout. I don't like it. Right? And two things came up this week. Josh Hart was asked about it, and he jokingly said that Tibbs has some kind of trauma he needs to get over. And then I saw someone mention that Tibbs in an interview, and I have not seen the interview, in fairness, mentioned that he was on the bench when Tracy McGrady had that famous, I forget, what was it? It was 13 points in 33 seconds. And for some of you younger fans, go look that up. One of the more amazing performances at the end of the game. And it was against the San Antonio Spurs, I believe. I'm pretty sure, right? And Tibbs was on the bench for that, apparently. He was an assistant coach. He wasn't a head coach. He was an assistant coach. And ever since then, he has kind of been in the game's not over and until it's over. And the conversation gets a little convoluted because a lot of times silly fans think the game is over when it's not. You know, so, you know, a 15-point lead with 1 minute to go, the game's over. Typically, the game's over. I get it. Tracy McGrady had an incredible run. But the game is typically over in that time. And it wasn't a 15-point lead that Tracy McGrady was coming back from in that time frame. He just scored 13 points. And a what, 20-point lead with 3 minutes to go? That game is over. That game is over. But in the case of OG, or if OG's out of the game, there was a point where OG was out of the game, and I think they brought him back with like 3 minutes to go. You don't need to bring him back. You don't need to bring him back. Like, I get it. You're trying to ramp up or whatever, but you don't need to bring him back. Those are the kind of things that he's clearly hurting. He's in pain. Don't do that. It's not necessary. Not necessary. Steve Popper reported at halftime because you saw him start shaking his elbow in the first half. It was like a one play that really like irritated it, and he was favoring it the rest of the game. At halftime, Steve Popper reported that he came out, took one shot, and talked to the trainers for the rest of the halftime. So what I have to imagine is that OG at the very least is not shooting a lot of shots in practice, after practice, whatever, like a lot of these players are known to do. He's not doing that. He's not doing that. Don't expect OG to knock any shots down on a consistent basis. I'm sorry. He's just not going to do it. Even the free throws, you can see him favoring his arm on free throws. He's not taking any extra shots. So he's going to be off. And another thing you took from this game is that Josh Hart, last couple games, has not been very confident shooting the ball. So I talked about this a few shows ago, how it's all about confidence and how he's been shooting the ball really, really well. I think I mentioned, maybe not on the show, but a reluctant shooter is worse than a bad shooter. And although you don't want Josh Hart shooting every single time he's open because he finds other ways to make plays, you want him to shoot the ball more often. And the problem is against better defensive teams and more disciplined defensive teams, they're not going to come running out to him when he's behind the three-point line if one, he's going to be a reluctant shooter, and two, not making that shot. Seems like he may have lost his confidence a little bit shooting the ball. And he was shooting the ball at least with a lot of confidence on top of shooting the ball well. And that's a little concerning. That's concerning. As the season winds down, you go into the playoffs, you really wanted Josh shooting the ball the way he was a week or so ago. And then on top of that, OG's not shooting the ball because of his elbow. So, you're looking at spacing issues that are really coming to a head if these guys don't turn it around. And there's a lot of games left. That's a good thing and a bad thing in terms of OG having all of those games to ruin his elbow. It didn't seem like the Knicks are that concerned about it, but geez. And but it's plenty of time for Josh Hart to kind of get his rhythm back shooting the ball because he's been amazing in every other aspect of the game, right? And Dante, he's also not shooting the ball nearly as well. And you're wondering, is he tired? Is he just not in the same rhythm? The same? He's not getting the same opportunities he was getting before. You hate to see that. You want him to get back to where he was before. He might just be wearing down a little bit. He doesn't seem like he has the same, pep to his step, but he's still there defensively, made some good defensive team plays last night. And that's the one thing that you have to say about this team, even though they're struggling sometimes on offense, that their offense sometimes comes from their defense. They force turnovers, they force bad plays, bad shots, and then because Josh Hart is like Magic Johnson now in transition, getting good opportunities for the team in transition, and they speed up the pace, and then it gives them more opportunities to get into rhythm and get the offense going. And now, of course, once again, Jalen Brunson with an amazing game. I actually didn't think he played that great. And then you look at the end of the game, he was just under 50% from the field, and it's just an amazing performance. That wasn't actually an amazing performance because you're just getting used to him being ultra efficient and even sharper than he was in this game. He banged his knee up a little bit in the second half, but he was still fine. This was just a game they needed to win. You're always looking for troubling trends. Bogdanovich and Burks are the troubling trend on top of what we've previously discussed. They are still terrible. Bogey's just getting worse and worse every game. And it's just really disheartening at this point. But we talked about this. They have, I think, until Julius Randle gets back, they have until then to figure themselves out. I still think Burks is doing two things wrong. Bogey was not doing this wrong when he was struggling before, and he's doing it wrong now. Burks just feels like he has to shoot. And he needs to stop. I don't mind him taking the threes, but I do hate the little contested mid-ranges he keeps taking there. He's rushing those shots. He's off balance, and that's part of his game, but it doesn't need to be part of the Knicks game. It doesn't have to be that doesn't have to be the case. Get yourself into the paint, Get yourself pump fake, step throughs. You know, you can do that too. How about you use that part of your game? I know he can do it, so do it. Don't rush those mid-range jump shots, you know? And stop feeling like you have to force those shots. Now, him coming off those screens and shooting the three, that's part of his game, but maybe not come into the game and do that. Maybe get yourself. I just saw Kevin Durant interview, one of the great scorers of all time. He doesn't walk on the floor just shooting threes, so maybe you shouldn't do it either, Alec. Come off those screens, get yourself into the lane, get yourself a little floater, take your time, stop rushing it. A lot of his shots are rushed. I think there might be some easy fixes with Alec. Alec is coming in just trying to shoot and be like instant offense from the outside when you kind of have to ease yourself into the game and stop thinking that you got to take those, you know, contested mid-range shots because you don't, you know, save that for the end of the shot clock when nothing else got done. So there's like some game theory and some approach to the game that he needs to adjust. And I'm kind of angry and frustrated that nobody's doing that with him. And if they are, he's being stubborn, but that's not his reputation. And at this point, he's been in the league long enough to have a reputation. So that's not his reputation. So somebody should be just giving him a little bit more direction. Bogdanovich is just off now. He's taking bad shots. They're not terrible shots. They look worse than they are, but they're not good shots. They're shots that he can make, and he's just way off. And he needs to slow it down, and he needs to compose himself. He needs to slow it. He needs to slow the game down and look for better opportunities. You know, pump fake and people in the air and that kind of stuff. And I understand they're really trying to get themselves going, and they don't have that many minutes now to do it because they're not playing well in the minutes. Once OG got back, he knew there was going to be a minute crunch. And when it comes down to it, Knicks need to win these games. And Bogey's coming into the game, and Brooks coming into the game, and they're hurting, literally hurting the team. Because you're not, they're not plus, you know, but they're not plus defenders. They can be average. I don't think Bogey's been as bad as people are trying to make it. I think that's a lot of narrative being married to narratives. He hasn't been terrible, even though he's been targeted. He's not been terrible, but he's not a plus defender. And you'd rather have somebody else in there if you're not going to be a plus defender and you're going to be terrible on offense. So what's the point of you being here? Because we can put a plus defender in the game. You know, so that's something you want to see straightened out. The Knicks have Sacramento next, 3 games left on this road trip. That's who they play after Sacramento. I'm getting old. So they play the Warriors. I'm guessing Steph Curry will be back for that game. Warriors on the road, always a tough game. And then they play the Nuggets. Yeah, that's no walk in the park. But that's part of the business. You know, I said the next thing was Sunday, but it's not Sunday, it's Saturday. So you want to take this Kings game. You want to take this game. It's a winnable game. I know the Kings are a tough team. They're playing for something in the standings. That doesn't mean you can't beat them. One of their strengths on the floor is obviously Sabonis, who's having a much better season than most people realize. He's really been outstanding from top to bottom. However, I have a hard time thinking that Sabonis is going to be the difference maker. If Hartenstein is 80%, if Precious is locked in. You know, I spoke to Brian Scalabrine. I got a chance to call NBA Radio, speak to Brian Scalabrine about the pending issue at center once Mitch comes back from injury. And he made a point about how big men don't necessarily need long stretches of minutes to get into rhythm, like a wing or a guard. And then you can maybe play the centers in short stretches. And have them give you all they got, and you know, you plug and play and not stress it, and that wouldn't be as bothersome as if you did that to a guard or a wing who they need more rhythm to get into the game. And that's not something, that's not a point that I would argue with someone who actually played big men in the NBA and played with big men. But the one thing I would say is that Precious has seemed to play better the more he plays. So one thing I would say about Precious, and that's what I touched on earlier, is he seems to get to that next gear the more he's in the game, as opposed to playing spot minutes and having to, gear up almost to that level. Because that's where he's been for most of his career. People say, well, how is Precious is playing differently now than he was playing before? Yeah, he is playing differently now than he was playing before. Absolutely. Why is that? Well, it's for several reasons. We can't get into all of them. We don't know all of them. Just be happy he's doing it. But one of them, to me, because I'm looking at this as someone who's watching him as a Knick, the more he played, the better he got. And the same thing at the center position. He started the Knicks season, or I should say, the Knick tenure, not being very good at backup center. At least as far as what the Knicks need him to do. And then he got better at it the more he played it. And when he came in as the backup power forward, when he first got here, it didn't, he wasn't doing anything special. He was a step late on everything. He wasn't confident around the rim. He wasn't confident making plays. And then he got to a point where, he'd dribble the ball from the three-point line and put a move on to get to the front of the rim. He'd take it upon himself to post someone up and get to the front of the rim. Dunking on guys, being aggressive, making reads on the floor, and defensively just hustling from sideline to sideline. And that's just not something you saw. That's not a gear that you saw from him early in his Knick tenure. But then you see a game like last night where he's being put in the game and he's a step slow on a lot of the plays. And that's not been his MO as a Knick, but that's been his MO in his NBA career. So I don't know if that works for Precious. So that's a concern. That's a concern of mine, right? But as they play Sacramento, if you get that kind of Precious effort and you get 80% of Hartenstein, I'm not saying Sabonis is not going to eat. He's going to eat, but I don't know if he's not going to be the hub for Sacramento's offense, in my mind, against those guys. Now, the referees always play a part, and the referees have been putting their whistles in their pockets. Something that, again, I'll keep giving Steve Popper credit for, because now the numbers are starting to reflect it. I saw Seth Partnow, Anchorage Man, on Twitter detail that the numbers reflect the referees have been blowing the whistle at a much lower rate since around February 1st. And I think I said it on the show that Steve Popper called it out almost immediately, that this is something that we were starting to see. And it was after Adam Silver made complaints about how maybe the rules have favored offenses a little bit too much. So the referees are always going to be a concern. Maybe they swallow the whistle. Maybe they turn the clock back and start giving fouls on those big men. And they have to play a little softer. But if they're allowed to actually play Sabonis, he's going to make some. He's going to get to the free throw line. But at the end of the day, they'll be able to slow him down enough to make sure that he's not the deciding factor in my mind. And then you might say, well, look at what Ayton did last night. I think he had 29 points and 13 rebounds. And the way Ayton got those 29 points and 13 rebounds is a little bit different. First of all, Ayton is one of those guys that doesn't play all the time. He's not playing with maximum effort all the time. For some reason, he decided to play maximum effort against the Knicks. He hit his first three of the season. I think it was the first attempt and first make of the season against the Knicks. Last night, you tend to see a lot of things like that. If you're a Knicks fan, you've been watching them for a long enough time, you've seen a lot of guys have like those firsts against the Knicks. He was really active. He was really aggressive. He took that mid-range jump shot, I thought, too much. But, he's pretty smooth with it on that mid-range, but he took a lot of contested mid-ranges that he probably shouldn't have taken. And at the rim, he hustled. He's an athletic big. He hustled. The Knicks are playing small a lot. Even with OG at power forward, the Knicks are still a little bit small, especially with OG playing a little bit hampered. They're not, muscling guys around the way they would if Precious was playing power forward, or obviously a Randall. And Hart, as great of a rebounder as he is, people are still going to jump over him. A guy like Ayton's still going to jump over him. So 13 rebounds is not the end of the world. He got his share of offensive rebounds. He got his share. When you look at rebounding, when you look at defensive rebounding, understanding if a team misses a lot of shots, there's going to be a lot of defensive rebounds. So, when the biggest man on the court just 13 rebounds. You don't break out the balloons and the confetti. And when one of the smaller guys on the court gets 16 rebounds, like a Josh Hart, that's when you do it. You know, those 29 points came because of his activity and the size advantage that he had against some of the Knicks when the center got moved off the spot and he was matched up at the front of the rim with smaller Knicks players. And that might happen with Sabonis as well, but I just thought that Ayton had a lot of life to his legs and was able to take advantage of his size around much smaller Knicks players, his size and athleticism around much smaller Knicks players a little bit more often than I think Sabonis is going to be able to do. Whereas Sabonis is probably going to get his share of offensive rebounds and put him up too. He's going to post up and score directly on guys as opposed to what Ayton did, where it was a lot of activity off the ball from the weak side, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't just go to him directly and get those points. Whereas Sabonis is going to have the ball in his hands a lot. He's going to be the primary attack guy, and it's just going to be a different animal. Now, is Sabonis still going to get some points and rebounds? Yes, but I don't think it's going to be the deciding factor in the game. Maybe that doesn't make sense. Maybe that sounds ridiculous to you. But to me, I always make a distinction between guys who are creating offense and guys who are benefiting from either having offense created for them or, you know, just their activity. Both have a value, but it comes in a very different way. When you are the primary attack guy, not only do you need to put points on the board, you have to do it efficiently, and you have to be able to create for other people. When, you know, let's say you get bogged down, are you going to force a shot, or you've got two people on you, are you going to make the right pass, which Sabonis is known to do, and create offense for other guys? A lot of times Sabonis is drawing double teams, and he's drawing a collapsed defense, and I don't think that shouldn't happen against the Knicks. I'm not saying it's not going to, but it shouldn't happen consistently. They should be able to at least slow Sabonis down with the guys that they have. Just, most teams don't have, you know, tough centers in the paint. If you look around the league, most teams don't have that. That's why most teams aren't competitive in the playoffs. It's the teams that are competitive in the playoffs that actually have tough bigs in the paint. In the regular season, guys get away with not having that. But in the playoffs, most of the successful teams have at least some strong big in the paint to provide resistance at the front of the rim. And the Knicks have that. Most teams don't. Most teams have to collapse defensively in the paint against Sabonis. And sometimes he's going to still score. And when he doesn't, he's going to make the right pass and let other people eat. Whereas the Knicks should not have to collapse their defense to slow Sabonis down. It doesn't mean he's not going to score his share of points, but it means he's probably not going to, he shouldn't, you know, get a bunch of hockey assist and direct assist numbers because he's collapsing your defense. We'll see how it plays out. The other side of the coin, you have De'Aaron Fox, an amazing offensive player. He's not shooting the ball very well in the season, but he can always get hot. He's super fast, super quick. You don't expect Brunson to be on him. They might hunt Brunson, get into the teeth of the defense. You know they keep their pace up, and the Knicks have historically this year been a poor transition team. I haven't seen the numbers recently because they've had so many different injuries. I wonder if they're better transition wise with OG and Hart starting on the front line than previous iterations of the lineups. But they've been bad in transition defense historically, and Sacramento is going to run up and down the floor and get the crowd involved and get their three-point shots up, et cetera, et cetera. But in the half court, you expect DiVincenzo to be the primary on Fox, and sometimes Hart to be a primary on Fox. With Murray out there, you probably will find OG on him. You might find OG on Fox, frankly, to be honest with you. You know, I don't know how much you want OG fighting over screens with this elbow issue, though. So we'll see. If Fox gets hot, a lot of times he gets into that mid-range area and gets those little floaters up, those little short jumpers. It makes life difficult for everybody. But the Knicks should have enough defenders to slow him down. So between their two best players, they should have I fear Fox a little bit more than Sabonis, and that's not a slight on Sabonis. I explained why I thought Sabonis could still get his numbers but not break the Knicks defense down enough to win the game. Whereas Fox, on the other hand, can break the Knicks defense down, whether he's using screens or whether it's transition, get to the middle of that defense, and he can be a threat shooting the ball or kicking the ball out and getting everybody else involved. So, slowing him down is priority number one, and you might just have to take your medicine with Sabonis. This is going to be a tough game for the Knicks to win, especially with OG not being full OG and Hartenstein possibly not being full Hartenstein. Everybody else, no excuses. You got shots. You're getting good shots. You're getting good opportunities. You got to step up, and these are the games you have to win because you can't expect to go into Denver and win. And if Curry is back, and I haven't looked at his injury timetable, but I believe he could be back in that game. Going to play the Warriors can be a pain in the butt, and it should be a revenge game against the Warriors, a game that you want to win, especially if Curry doesn't play. But even if he does, you want to go out there and give them a run for their money because he's probably not going to be sharp coming off the injury if he does play. But I actually think he's going to be back in the game right before. And they're playing for something. All these teams are playing for something. And they see an opportunity to win. They're not going to look at the Knicks right now with them not shooting well and with OG's hurt arm. It's an OG in a game with Draymond Green with this elbow is a scary proposition, to be very honest with you. Draymond Green is just the type of player to aggravate that elbow for no reason whatsoever, just because he's a brick. But you're likely not going to finish out this road trip with a win in Denver. Obviously, the Portland win had to be gotten. You would hope, even if Curry comes back, he's coming back from injury. He's playing against the Lakers, I think Saturday. Curry's a machine. I'm not going to sit here and predict Curry not being sharp. That's just a fool's errand. But you got to take one of the Kings in the Warriors games. You got to. And then you take what you can get against the Nuggets. You're probably going to take the L there. And if you get the win, that's a bonus. But you got to get at least Warriors, one of Warriors and Kings. So, Kings up next. I'll be there. Can't wait. Before we go, actually, let me send my condolences to the Barrett family, RJ Barrett's younger brother. Nathan Barrett passed away from illness. It's really terrible news. We don't know what the illness was, and frankly, it's none of our business. As much as we would like to know, it's really none of our business. And if they don't choose to share it with us, then it is what it is. Speculating is really kind of classless, to be honest with you. I believe he was 20 years old, so it's really incredibly sad. And the older you get in life, the more you appreciate how precious life is, right? Because people pass away when you're younger, people who aren't close to you, and you kind of shake it off. And but as you get older and people close to you pass away, you start to appreciate those losses a little bit more. And when you see a young person whose life was ahead of them, not behind them, it really weighs on you heavy. When someone has lived a long life and they've had their time, that's just the cycle of life. But at 20 years old, that's a tragedy. So RJ, doesn't matter if RJ's wearing a Knick uniform or not, and frankly, it doesn't matter if he's an ex-Knick, an NBA player, or just a neighbor down the street. When someone loses a 20-year-old little brother, my heart goes out to them, and people pass away every day, and I send my best wishes and prayers to all of you.
But hey, all the best to the Barrett family and RJ Barrett. Sucks to end the show like that, but probably sucks to begin the show like that. It just sucks. Make sure you follow at Sports Ethos, at Ethos Knicks. Until next time.